Let's focus on the next part of this chapter. We are, we are currently in chapter 6, about ready to finish chapter 6. This quiz tomorrow is on chapter 6. And let's see what we are doing in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is about work and energy. We apply a force to an object, and it gets displaced while it's being displaced. Okay? And we do work. We are just looking at the case where we have constant forces. There are variable forces, forces that change as the object's moving. One example is a mass on a spring, which we're going to look at a little bit later. So we're not going to look at the last section of this chapter on variable forces. Right now we want to just deal with constant forces. So we have a constant force applied to an object through the whole time that it's going through here. And S is the displacement. The work that's done is essentially the force times the distance, but we're really looking at the horizontal component of the force. So it's F cosine theta times the distance. This is newtons times meters, which we found out can be relabeled as a new unit called joules. Another type of object related to this is energy. And our first case of energy is this thing called kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is the energy of motion. It's very simply given by 1/2 mv squared. The faster an object is going, the more kinetic energy it has. Bigger objects moving at the same speed will also have more kinetic energy. There's a relationship between these two, the work and the kinetic energy, that I can look at the work that's done while this force is acting on the object. The force is acting on this body, causing an acceleration. So this body is going to have a velocity at one point, a different velocity at another point. So if I look at the change in the kinetic energy that that body undergoes, I can use that to compute the work. So this is a theorem. The work is by definition given by this force times distance part. The change in kinetic energy has to do with the motion. Okay, and then we put those pieces together and look at that. We want to look at this work energy theorem in a little bit more detail. What this work energy theorem really does is it accounts for any energy in the problem. Okay, it can account for energy losses and those types of things. So what we're going to end up talking about is something called energy conservation. Okay, by the time we're done today. Okay. Then let's see. Let's look at sort of a schematic of the problem that we were doing the other day with the skier. Okay, the idea was we had some kind of an incline. I have an object going down the incline. In this case, we're not going to focus so much on the fact that it was a skier, but we keep that in the back of our mind. Okay, that particular problem. Here's an object. At a later point, it's down there. We have an initial velocity, a final velocity. The object has some mass m, and this object is sliding down the incline. If there were no friction on this object, we know that the acceleration of the object going down the incline is given by g sine theta. Okay, we saw that in the quiz, we saw that in the lab, we saw that in a derivation last week, right? So by now we know that that's true. Where did that g sine theta come from? It came from the component of the work along the incline. So there is an overall force, mg sine theta, due to gravity, right? That's the component of gravity in the direction of motion that this is going. This object is going to be displaced from the first point to the final point. is being displaced by S. Note that in this chapter, we're using S for displacement because it doesn't have to necessarily be in the X direction. Okay, so that object's going downhill. Now, the other feature of that problem was that there was friction. In general, there could be friction, right? In real life, there's friction. So we could go in and throw some friction in this problem. Which way is the friction action? Uphill. As opposed to the last problem on the quiz, this mass is going downhill. There is friction, but this friction is what kind of friction? Kinetic, because it's moving, as opposed to the car that was parked on the hill. So I have kinetic friction pointing uphill. But the object's still going downhill, right? Unless the friction is strong enough that, you know, force is not big enough to overcome the static friction. So there is the possibility that, well, if these two actually cancel, this could be going downhill at a constant velocity with no acceleration, in which case the net force acting on it is zero, and there's no work being done by the net force. If I add these two up, I can figure out what the net force is in this direction, multiply it times the distance, and I get the work. That's what we did in that problem at the end of the last lecture. Okay? And we were looking at it in terms of using an application of the work energy theorem. So let's see. The work energy theorem tells me the change in kinetic energy, I'm going to flip this around for a reason, is equal to the work that's done. The change in kinetic energy here is I look at the 1/2 mv0 squared initially, I look at the 1/2 mv squared finally, I take the difference of those two things, right? We know how to compute that. The work, let's go back. How did I get the work? The work is equal to the force times the distance times the cosine of the angle between the net force acting on this and the displacement. Well, the net force is parallel to the displacement. In fact, it's in the same direction. Agree? So the angle between the net force and S is what? Zero. So cosine of zero, that's out. So I just have to take the net force, which is, okay, so looking at this particular problem, mg sine theta is in the direction of S. So that's mg sine theta. And the Fk is actually in the opposite direction, so that's one way you could look at why there's a negative. So we just look at the difference between these two forces, multiply that times S, and that's how you compute the work. Okay, so I'm just reviewing quickly, but without numbers, that problem we did the other day. But it doesn't have to be a skier, okay? Just some object going down an incline. There's some frictional force involved in this particular problem. Now, what I would like to do is identify a few things here. We noted that the first term has to do with gravity, right? So the work done corresponds to two terms. We're going to have the work done by gravity. That's the first term. Plus, there's a work corresponding to the friction times S, right? S is going down, friction is going up, so minus FKS is the work being done by the frictional force. So we have to work done by friction. Right, so we have two forces in the problem that are doing work. So I'm breaking up this W that was in the problem we saw. Okay, we have work being done by gravity, work being done by friction. The work being done by friction, again, is opposite to S, so that minus sign does go in to writing down what the work done by friction is, right? The work done by friction is negative, the work done by gravity is positive in this case. Okay, now these are two really different types of forces, okay? And we're going to see that. Essentially, the work done by friction is an energy loss. Okay, we can't regain it, right? If I have that object slide downhill and then for some reason then we lift it back up to the top, okay, we've lost some energy. However, I could restore the energy, okay, or take care of this work that was done by gravity. Okay, if I have an object up here and I bring it down, the work done by gravity is going to be equal to the work it takes to bring this back up to the top of the hill. Okay, there are two different types of forces, and this will lead to something called conservative forces, which is kind of a strange thing in the chapter. Okay. But what I want to do is actually focus a little more on the work done by gravity. This is fairly special, and we're going to pay more attention to it. Okay. Okay, let's take a look at this work that's done by gravity. So let me write W gravity. In this problem, the work done by gravity is mg sine theta times s. All right, that's that first term. I can rewrite this in a little bit more suggestive form. We'll note that as the mass goes from location 1 to location 2, it's actually going through a change in height. So what I can do is I can rewrite this in terms of the height. So let's indicate the heights. The height of the object is at the top, right? Well, that's the initial position, right? So let's call that h sub 0 for the initial height. All right, we measure the height from, let's say, the ground. Right, we can actually measure it from anywhere, but it makes sense to measure it from the ground right now. And the final height, wherever I'm interested in calling the final observation point, would be h here. All right, that final height could be the ground. It could be before the ground. All right, depends what I'm interested in. All right, there are the heights. We'll notice that there is a right triangle and another right triangle. And if I look at that right triangle, let me take that right triangle and blow it up a little more. At least separate it from that diagram. So what's the hypotenuse of this triangle?
S.
Down the stairs, that angle, everybody agree that's the same as the angle of the incline. Okay? How could I figure out what this side is here? In terms of the heights. No, in terms of h's. I just want to know what this is in terms of h's first. Just the change in the height, just like the lab we did the other day, right? H0 is higher, so this, and h is lower, so that height is just h0 minus h. But as Aaron was pointing out, we could also get this height using trig functions. This height is, how can I get this height using trig functions? For example, since I was given S, given theta, can you get it this height?
So theta is delta H over S.
This is opposite sign, right? Okay, so we have here that S times the sine of theta is equal to the height, which we've already indicated is H0 minus H. S sine theta is a factor in the work done by gravity. So let's rewrite the work done by gravity as mg times the difference in the heights. Okay. So now we see the work done by gravity only depends upon the mass of the object, of course, and the change in the height. Okay. Well, I'm going to go back here. Well, let's see. Let's go back to my equation. So what does that tell me? I have the change in kinetic energy is equal to now me write it this way. The work done by gravity plus the work done by...
I'll put a little F for friction.
Okay. So it's just writing out what I put in words here. And the work done by gravity is mg h0 minus h. This almost looks like if I multiply it out, it would be the change, right? I could write delta something, right? All right, this is mgh0 minus mgh. The only problem is it's the initial minus the final. But I can fix that. Let me bring that to the other side and write the change in kinetic energy. Okay, I have mgh0, so we can subtract mgh0. And I have minus mgh, and I can add that to both sides. So basically, I'm going to get plus mgh minus mgh0 is equal to w. So the point is, if I bring the mgh0 to the other side, it'll have negative. Bring the mgh to the other side, it'll become positive. Okay, now, this looks like the final value of something minus the initial value of something, doesn't it? Guess what? We're going to define that. Let's define the gravitational potential energy plus the change in the potential energy is equal to the work done by friction. Okay. So it's nice that I can express this thing as the change in two values that only depend upon the value at the beginning of the process and at the end. Okay, so that's a nice feature of this. I'm just going to call this PE and not PE grav or something like that. There are plenty of other types of potential energy, but right now the only potential energy that we'll be interested in for a couple of chapters anyway is gravitational potential energy. Okay. So what else can I write here? Let's see. The change... Let me write this out. Because sometimes we'll see this written out and we'll need it written out. So what does this tell me? This says 1 half mv squared minus 1 half mv sub 0 squared. That's the change in the kinetic energy. Plus, and the change in the potential energy was what I had previously. So I'll just write that as mgh minus mgh 0. Notice written out, we can see that the change in kinetic energy plus the change in potential energy could also be rearranged by looking at those two quantities, the final potential energy, the final potential energy, right? Add these kinetic plus the potential, okay, for the final. And what's left is I'm subtracting what the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is initially. So let's see, how could I do this? I could define 1 half mv squared plus mgh to be the total kinetic plus potential energy at any given time. In this case, that would be the final value, right? And what's left, the minuses, would turn out to be this quantity if I just put sub-zeros on there, right? It would be the initial total value of these. I'm going to call this the total mechanical energy. And we find that if I and rewrite this equation, I get E minus the initial value of E equal to Wm. Or in other words, the final value of the energy minus the initial value, well, it's not zero, it's equal to the work done by friction. Okay. Or I could write E minus delta, or I could write this as a delta, can't I? Okay, so the change in total energy is equal in this problem to the energy due to friction. What if there were no friction? Then this difference would be zero, which means that the final energy would be equal to the initial energy. But the friction is, we know about friction, right? You rub your hands, you feel heat, right? This object sliding down, right? There is some heat generated, or there's some energy loss. Okay, as this block sliding down the hill. So what if I had a frictionless incline, or I had very little energy loss, right? Then I could account for the fact that, you know, whatever energy I had at the top is going to be equal to the energy I have at the bottom. This is essentially what energy conservation will amount to. All right, so I've gone through this and just played with this example where I have an object at one position, then at another, just on this theorem, the work energy theorem. Right? We can deal with the kinetic energy. I broke up the work and said the work was due to two things. Work done by gravity. Gravity was pulling the object down. And work done by friction. If there's no friction, then that difference is only work done by gravity. So I broke it into two pieces, looked closer at the work done by gravity, and found out that I could write down the work done by gravity very simply in terms of the change in something called the potential energy. What I want to do now is make sense out of this problem that I just wrote up. Okay. It all looks good right now. It all looks mathematical, but let's see what we can think about physically. What if there were no energy loss? All right, so let's write down what I stated. What if there was no work done, but right? There's no friction. So there's no energy loss due to the friction. What do we say in that case? And the change in the total energy is zero. Change in the total mechanical energy is zero in this case if there were no friction involved. Now I can think of a couple ways that no friction or similar types of things could be involved, or at least a good approximation to get started. Okay, this implies that the final, I could write this as final is equal to initial. An I there, I could put a sub-zero, whatever. Right, every once in a while, you'll see the book now starting to put some sub-Fs in there for final values to clarify that that's the final value. But delta E equals zero just means that the energy at any point on the path, the total mechanical energy, is the same number at all times because there's no energy loss. Okay, this is essentially what's called the conservation of mechanical energy. Now we can classify the types of forces which would lead to losses. Okay, but I won't get into that right this minute. Let's just assume, okay, that we do have conservation of energy. When will we have it? Well, we could have it when we have objects going down inclines with no friction. Okay, we could have this if I just drop an object. So if I take this box and I drop it, okay, actually that would break the chalk. So if I drop it, as long as it's falling, okay, there's no friction. Well, there could be a little air resistance, right, but it's small enough that I can neglect it. Okay. So we can look at that. So let's look at some examples and see how to put this general theory into practice. All the ingredients for the whole chapter, except for the one section, are sitting right there in front of us. In fact, the whole chapter is sitting right there. Okay, so let's see what everything I said means. We're going to start with a very simple example. Let's start with an object, like a ball. And this object has some mass. Okay, now let's say I drop it from here and I drop it through 1 meter. So I want to drop the object so that it falls down here and it goes 1 meter. Chapter 2, we talked about this kind of problem. We call it free fall, right? And we should be able to figure out how fast that ball is going when it hits the ground. All right, just go to your kinematic equations and figure it out. Okay. We're going to do a little better this time. So let's assume that the initial velocity is zero. I'm interested in what the final velocity is. But what I'm going to do is use this notion that the energy is conserved. So what does that mean? It means come over here and look at the value for the total mechanical energy initially. Look at the value for the total mechanical energy afterwards. And those numbers should be the same if I'm not losing any energy due to things like air, you know, drag on the ball from the air and that time. Okay, so we're assuming that we're not losing any energy. All right, is that a safe assumption?
Maybe.
Okay, so what is the total energy before? The total energy, again, is 1/2 mv squared plus mgh. It's the kinetic energy to start plus the potential energy to start. Since I'm talking about the initial values, right, we, of course, we need to put in a subscript on the V and the H. We are assuming, of course, that this mass is not disintegrating on its way, right, so the mass stays fixed. All right. So there's my total initial energy in general. My total final energy is 1/2 mv squared plus mgh. Again, this total is kinetic energy plus potential energy. Okay. All right, now let's investigate what this problem gives me for these values. Point is that the conservation energy says whatever number I get up here should be equal to whatever number I get down here. Okay. All right, what is the initial kinetic energy? Say what? Initial kinetic energy. Is it moving to start? Right? I just let go of it, right? At the very beginning, it's not moving. So the kinetic energy of a body that does not move is?
Zero.
All right, let me put that down so you have it in your notes. Zero. When? I need to say something about what the height is, don't I? In some of these problems, we are at freedom to pick where h is zero. And where would you like to pick h equal to zero?
At the top.
At the top? Well, you could pick h equal to zero at the top, but I would do it at the bottom. All right. Point is, you could do either. I'm going to pick this to be h equals zero. You could pick h equals zero up here. Right? And then down here you would get a negative value for h, right? So you could do it just like we did with free fall. That's why everybody wanted to pick it up here, right? Okay. Okay, or I could just say, let's put the ground at zero height and come up here and put my initial height at what? 1. So 1 meter. All right, so now I come over here. Let's see. This is mg times 1. Let's come down to the final position, right? Typically in these problems, you're going to have 2 points. You're going to have an initial point. You're going to have a later point. Okay? You have to look at 1/2 mv squared plus mgh. Initial point, look at that value at the final point. Now we look at the final point. Okay, C. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared, because we don't know what v is, so I can't plug it in. What is the height?
Zero.
So, just add zero. Okay, so again, you look at the totals. Now, what did I say, set them equal? So we set them equal, and we say, what? Final is equal to initial. Final is 1/2 mv squared. The initial is mg times 1. Solve that for v. How do we solve for v? I both sides by m, multiply by 2, I get v squared is 2g, so v is equal to square root of 2 times g. The square root of 2 times g, 2 times 9.8, take the square root of that, you get
4.4.
So that tells me if I take an object and I drop it 1 meter, by the time it hits, right before it hits the ground, right, it's going to be going at 4.4 meters per second. What if I had a different height? How would the problem change if this were 2 meters? Well, the velocity would change. How would this, where would I change this? Let's see. If this were some general height, what would get affected? This one wouldn't be there, right? So we could just put this in general with some height. Leave it as h0. In fact, let me know so we see what I'm changing. All right. Make that h0, which means this would be h0. That would be h0. That would be h0. And now, in general, I can tell you if I drop an object from any given height, how fast it should be going right before it hits the ground, if the ground, of course, were at h equals 0. Okay? Notice I didn't have to recall any free fall equations to do this problem. I claimed you could do this using free fall, right? So it's just another method. This is an energy method. Now let me say a few things about this problem. All right, here I've got a ball. Okay, I'm going to drop it up. At this point, it's got a certain potential energy, right? It's at rest. No kinetic energy. When I drop it, and it drops down to a certain height, what happens? It speeds up. Kinetic energy is getting bigger, right? This kinetic energy is getting bigger. The potential energy is getting smaller. What's happening is that all that potential energy is now turning into kinetic. How did I get this ball to have that energy to begin with?
Lifted it up off the ground.
So I lift it up. Okay, I could throw it up. I could give it a little initial kinetic energy. It could go up. All that kinetic energy could become potential energy. Okay? Or I could just, if I gradually lift it up without accelerating it, then the amount of work that I am doing to lift it up is going to be equal to the gravitational work required to pull it back down, the gravitational energy. So what I'm really doing in the case of potential energy is storing energy. And so potential energy in general is stored energy. In fact, the amount of work it takes for me to bring this up, working against gravity, because you know I've got to bring it up and work against gravity, and if I bring it at a constant velocity, that means that the amount of force I'm pushing up on it should be equal to the weight. Alright? Because gravity's pulling down, I'm trying to pull it up. Right? If I pull it up at with the same force that gravity is trying to pull it down, then I'm applying that force to a distance, and I am doing work. In fact, we can compute that work. Alright? As I am lifting up this object, again, I have to stress that I am lifting that object up at a constant velocity, because if I lift it up and accelerate it, I'm actually doing even more work because my force is greater than the force of gravity. So the amount of work I have to lift it by is what? The force, right? I'm compensating the weight of the object. Lift it up a certain height, h. Let's say I bring it from 0 to some height, h. The amount of work that I'm doing is that force times this distance. So how much work am I doing? MGH. That's the amount of work that I'm doing. Okay? Doesn't that look familiar? So the work that I do to lift this object is precisely the potential energy that that object will have when it gets to that height. I am storing energy. Storing it for what? So I can let go of it and have it go down and do work in the form of changing this into kinetic energy. Alright? So the potential energy can go into kinetic. Problem back here. This is a little more complicated because somehow somebody looked at this box with a skier up here. There was work that was done to get the skier up here. Now the skier is going to change that stored energy into kinetic energy, right? As they go down the hill. There's a little problem. Friction. Some of that energy that was stored does not completely go back into kinetic energy because some of it gets lost to friction. Okay, so friction, of course, is a culprit in some of these problems. Okay. It's a little harder to take care of. All right, so there's a simple example of dropping an object. Let's do another type of an example similar to this one, but again with no friction. To get down to this idea. All right, so here I have an example. And let's say we have a hill. Notice how my hill does not look like an incline, or a nice perfect incline like we had before. And let's say I have a bicycle. All right, so we got a little bicycle here. And let's say it's right at the edge of the hill, somebody gives it a little push just to get it started. Okay, we'll assume that there is no frictional loss in this problem. And we want the cyclist to just coast down the hill. Okay, so let's assume that V0 equals 0. Let's say that this is a 10 meter high hill. And the question is, how fast is the cyclist coasting when the cyclist gets to the bottom of the hill? So assuming that we have no energy loss in this problem, what we're going to do is the same type of thing we did with the ball problem. We say, what is the total energy to start with? What is the total energy at the end? If energy is conserved, they should be equal. Okay. So my total energy, let's see. Well, let's look first off at the kinetic energy in general, without plugging numbers in. Okay, so the total, well, major numbers. If I have the cyclist that rests at the very top of the hill, what is the total energy at the top of the hill?
Zero.
Total kinetic energy.
Okay. And then what's the potential energy? Well, let's see. Let me take H to be zero at the bottom of the hill. Okay, nice logical place to take H to be zero. So that I can now write the potential energy. What is the potential energy?
MGH.
Just MGH. Okay. So the potential energy is mg times the height. Well, let's see. I'll call this 10 meters my height. Okay, or if you want, you can call it H0. Okay, but this is H is 10 meters. So I guess I'll put H0 to be consistent. All right. What do we have down here? What is the potential energy at the bottom of the hill?
Zero.
What is the kinetic energy at the bottom of the hill? 1/2 mv². Notice the similarities between the problems. Okay, we can compute the potential energy and the kinetic energy at any point on the path. If energy is conserved, the total of these two at the top should be equal to the total of these two at the bottom. Okay? So let's add these. Total, add these two together, I get mgh0. Add the two at the bottom, we get 1/2 mv². The masses go out. I can solve this for V, and I get V is square root of 2gh0. Does that look familiar?
Yeah, it's just as if I had dropped the ball from this height.
All right. Okay, we might as well get the numbers out. Square root of 2 times 9.8 times 10. 14 what?
14 meters per second. Everybody agree? It's 14. Just take their word for it. That's pretty good so far. Of course, everybody should be practicing.
And that's
joule. This is speed.
So meters per second. Okay, so this cyclist is going 14 meters per second at the bottom of the hill. Okay. What if V0 is 5 meters per second? Instead of the cyclist just beginning to coast down, what if somehow the cyclist came up the side of the hill, was going at 5 meters per second, and was getting ready to go down, right? Was tired from coming up the side of the hill and wants to coast the rest of the way. All right, so now we have an initial V0 of 5 meters per second. How does that change my problem? It changes the initial kinetic energy. So now the initial kinetic energy is 1/2 mv² The potential energy initially is mgh0. So add these together to give me an initial energy equal to the sum. 1/2 mv² plus mgh0. We want this to be equal to the final. So the final energy was what? 1/2 mv². If energy is conserved, these two expressions are equal. And so now we go through and set those equal. 1/2 mv² plus mgh. It is 1/2 mv². am I looking for? I'm looking to find out what B is, right? It's no longer going to be 14 meters per second. What do you think it's going to be, greater than or less than 14 meters per second? Greater than. All right. See, we have a feeling for these answers we should be getting. Sometimes we just don't get them. Okay. All right, divide through by M, because there's an M in every single term. And multiply by 2 to get rid of this. So I'm going to have a B squared. Multiply this by 2. I have a B0 squared plus 2. Notice my final velocity when I solve for this is going to be bigger than the initial velocity. Right? Because I'm just adding something here. Right? This is going to be, when I take the square root of both sides, this is going to be bigger than V0. Alright, so let's see. V is equal to the square root. V0 is what, 5? Squared plus 2 times 9.8 times 10. Plug our numbers in, and what do we get?
Fourteen point nine.
Well, you would have expected a lot more than that, wouldn't you? Maybe not. All right, we're going 5 meters per second. Here is more than you were initially, and when you get down here, you're only going about 1 meter per second more. That might challenge your intuition. What other types of things can we do? All right. Another example. What if my cyclist is going uphill? All right. Let's say my cyclist is coming along and there's this big hill sitting here. Now we'll keep it at 10 meters. And the cyclist is going and going and going, and it comes over here and wants to coast up the hill. Obviously, you can't do that with a zero initial velocity, so let's give the cyclist some initial velocity. Let's say the cyclist is coming at 10 meters per second. What do you expect?
He's going to slow down.
All right. That's the first thing. We're going to slow down. Why? Go back to what I was talking about before. We have a certain amount of kinetic energy here. When I start to go up the hill, that energy is going to get stored as potential energy. All right? You're going to lose kinetic energy, which means, of course, you're slowing down. Okay? What will this be, the speed at the top of the hill? What?
Pause.
Did you say pause? Anybody agree with?
Let's find out.
Let's find out. And the correct answer is this person doesn't get to the top of the hill. Why? How fast does this person have to be going to get to the top of the hill?
14.
At least 14. Right, come back here. If you just coast down, right, the total energy up here equal to the total energy there, just coasting down. You need 14 meter per second speed at the bottom of the hill to coast high enough to take all that energy and turn it into potential energy. So you've got to be going at least 14 to get up here. So the correct answer is no, the person does not make it to the top of the hill. The person stops somewhere. So the person is going to come along here. Is not going to make that. We're going to get up to some height. All right, let's call this H. Say what? Nothing? Okay. I talk to myself too. Sometimes it's like 8 o'clock and 9:40.
Okay. Just coasting to the top.
Yes, we're not pedaling, right? So the idea is that if you're coming along at 10 meters per second, you better start pedaling. Right? That's where you may not know that ahead of time, right? I mean, how many people are going to pedal and say, oh, that looks like a 10-meter hill. Let me quick do some physics. Right? Or at least a physics computation, right? You'll say, I'll do the experiment. I'll see if I can make it. If I can't make it, I'll pedal. Right? That's the usual way. You experiment. You try it out. All right. Again, what do I have? I have kinetic energy at the bottom of 1/2 mv0 squared. That's the total kinetic energy at the bottom. Pick H to be 0 again down here, so I have all kinetic energy, and it's going to come up here to some height, and what's going to happen at this height? All that kinetic energy is 0, right? Which means the final velocity is 0 at this point. I don't know what the height is. So let's see, what's the total energy at this point? Kinetic is 0, it must all be potential energy, so the total energy at this point is mgh. So as you're beginning to see in these problems, we're not memorizing one humongous formula. Or I may have derived some ugly stuff back here on the board earlier. Okay? But what we're doing is looking at the pieces. You have to know the definition for kinetic energy. You have to know gravitational potential energy, because that's the only potential energy we know to date. Okay? And we have to know whether there's any energy loss or not. And right now we're assuming there is none. Okay, 1/2 mv squared, total initial energy is equal to total final kinetic energy, final mechanical energy, which is going to be what, mgh. So I can see a pattern. Okay, solve this. See the m go up. Well, this time I'm solving it for h, though. So solving this for h, the m's go out, divide by g, I get h is v0 squared over 2g. Is that right? Plug in their numbers. V0 was what? 10 squared over 2 times 9.8. 9.8 is about 10. 10 divided into that, that's 10 over 2, roughly 5. What's the exact? 5.1. Those have to do some estimates. You'll know once you put it in your calculator, you get it right. Sometimes people put things on their calculator. I read on their quiz. They get all the numbers there, and some weird, strange thing comes out.
Wouldn't it just be meters?
Yes. I didn't do that. Okay. So, we only get halfway up the hill. Right? So there are all other kinds of things we can do with these kinds of problems. Before I go off and play with some other types of examples, let me take a quick break. Okay. And we can summarize. I started off looking at the problem of the going down the incline in a little more general fashion. Okay. And this is what we ended up with. Okay, first off, we have the total mechanical energy is given by the sum of the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. We can look at the total mechanical energy of a body that a body will have at different times. Okay. First off, kinetic energy. We defined kinetic energy yesterday to be 1/2 mv squared. Potential energy. There is only one form of stored energy that we know so far, and that's gravitational potential energy. Typically, that I can store energy by changing the height that a body is in a gravitational field. Right? There are other ways to store energy. We can store energy electrically, we can store energy in springs, and there are other types of ways to store energy that we'll see at some other point. But right now, the only type of stored energy we have is just by lifting an object up. We store the energy by doing some work. We let go of it. We can have that potential energy, that stored energy, converted into other types of energy like kinetic energy. If the total mechanical energy at any point on the path is a constant, then we said, they say that the mechanical energy has been conserved. This is the conservation of mechanical energy. We will use this tomorrow in the lab as we look at some collision experiments and talk a little bit more about conservation of mechanical energy. What does this amount to? We could write this out in full detail. We can write 1/2 mv squared plus mgh is equal to 1/2 mv0 squared plus mgh0 as some big ugly formula, okay? But we don't want to do that. We want to think about the principle, right? This, some of these two is the total energy, right? Look at it at one point, look at it at another point. If energy is conserved, then we're fine here, okay? Let's say that initially I have a certain amount of energy, and then I look at it finally and find out they're not equal. That means some energy's been lost somewhere. Typically lost due to things like friction, right? Friction is a type of force that does not help to conserve energy. So this is called a non-conservative force. Friction, air resistance. So these are non-conservative, which means they don't conserve energy. All right, there's energy loss involved, just like the problem with the box going down the slide with friction. We can account for the energy loss by just looking over here and taking the difference between these two. All right, so if I take the difference between how much energy I started with and how much I ended up with, I can write down how much energy was lost. Now the book writes down that loss as WNC. NC, non-conservative. So there's work due to non-conservative forces. This is just like WF in that problem that I had before, right? When I wrote down, I said the work done by friction, that is the energy due to a non-conservative force. Right, that is really just energy loss, nothing else. Okay, how do I recognize whether I have a non-conservative force or the corresponding conservative force? Okay, gravity is conservative. That's all we know. If there's any friction or anything like that, right, it's not conservative. It's not conservative. For the most part, we're not going to run into any too many things other than those forces. Okay, so we're not going to make a big deal out of those. Now, some other types of examples we have up on the web. I'm going to do a little. Now, I'll also remind you, we do have things on the web, right? So under the materials section, chapters 5 to 7, okay, we got some work energy stuff. As I mentioned yesterday, I guess, right, amusement parks are wonderful for physics. Okay, so here is a usual type of roller coaster ride. Okay, yes, sir.
Can you kill these lights?
I don't know. Now people can't see. All right, we're testing out how much we can see. Did you see? So here's a nice roller coaster ride, right? Here we have people coming along, of course, like going upside down or whatever. But the point is, here we have some mass. Comes up to a certain height, slides down. What happens when it slides down? It goes faster and faster because all that potential energy is being converted to kinetic. We hope that we do not have much energy loss. All right, so you have to have some nice bearings or different types of systems for following this track. So you come up here. Then you go down fast, and then you come up, and but you get up to this height, right? You're not up as high as that one, so you would expect, well, again, if there's no energy loss, you have enough energy to keep going. Okay, and so you can design things like roller coaster systems. In fact, there's a nice little applet here which allows you to play around with those. There's different things here about roller coaster physics. So Here's a little applet which allows you to design your own little roller coasters. Right? You can have hills and valleys, and you can have a loop. Okay, and of course you can have a car. There are different hills. Here's a hill. You control the hills. With two, you can control that. Higher and lower. And there's a loop. You can control the initial speed, the mass of the object, friction. So this one actually has some friction in there. Click on it, and it doesn't go. Because its initial speed is exactly the RSV little speed. But that's not the exact speed. So we have a little cart that goes up. Okay, so it doesn't have quite enough energy to get up here, because you'll notice there's a little bit of friction. But I do have some energy loss. I should feel that. It just keeps going back and forth. So now it's oscillating. You can tell that it didn't get all the way back up. Why? Because there was friction, right? So let me get rid of that energy loss. Let's see if I can do it. You're going to be able to get it to go back. It went higher because it didn't have that friction loss, right? So it went back to where it started. Well, that's good. Let's see if we could speed it up a little. This should get it going, right? Okay. We could go to hill one and make hill one a little higher. Right? That's the only thing I changed. Then it should go a little faster as it goes, right? Okay, so energy conservation. Alright, so that's something you can play with when you get tired of staring at the textbook. Different forms of energy conservation. Okay, so let's see. Just a couple more things to introduce and a couple more comments. Right. Get much further on energy conservation type ideas. There's one more related subject that's given, and this is the last section that we're covering in this chapter, and that's on something called power. Power is related to work. All right, remember work? We started off the chapter talking about work, right? We're doing work. We do work to store energy, etc. All right, work is related to the change in kinetic energy. So what happens if I have a certain amount of work to do? Well, let's see. I need to move an object by applying a certain force, move that object through a distance. Okay, so for example, I could move some object from here to Raleigh. Right. In the old days, we could do that by carrying it, walking with it, use a horse, use a carriage. Then we got to use cars. Okay, why would we prefer cars over going there with a horse? It's faster. Okay. So even if we're doing the same work, if we were applying the same force over the same distance, we're doing it faster, which requires more power. Of course, I could have done it then faster, too. I just had to add a couple more horses. All right? So, power. Capital P for power. Often, force is not necessarily constant. We could actually put an average on that and talk about the average power. And all the power is how much work have I done in a given amount of time. So this is the work per time. That's power. Do a certain amount of work, do it in an hour. All right? If I'm really ambitious, I'll do it in a half hour. All right? Needs more power to do that. Okay, let's see. Power has units. So power is not really a difficult subject, right? This is like a breeze compared to the first part of the chapter. Okay. Power has units. What are the units of work?
Joules.
Time? Seconds. One joule second actually has a name. It's called a watt. Named after another
deceased person. How does that translate to like a light bulb? So it's like 30 watts.
Okay, well, how does that translate? We'll find out better in the second half of the course. But for a light bulb, you have something called current, and you have volts. All right, the current and voltage contribute to the light. Essentially, for a light bulb, what do we have? We have a certain amount of energy that's coming off the bulb per time. All right, remember, work is just energy. We have so much energy. In that case, it's electrical work. All right, which we'll learn about in the second half. Okay. Though, since we're on the subject, right, you look at your electrical bills. What do you get in your electrical bill? You get charged for what? Kilowatt hours. See, I can see some people read their bills. So in your electrical bills, you get charged for kilowatt hours. Kilo, what's that?
1,000.
Kilowatt would be 1,000 watts. That's power. Hours is time. Power times time is?
Work.
That's energy, right. Bring the time up, right? Power times time is energy. Okay, right. Work is energy. Right. So, what are you paying for here? You're paying for electrical energy. Okay? Which, of course, is being taken care of by running your light bulbs at so many watts for so many hours. Right. So, that's essentially all power is. We can play games with our average power. The average power is the work per time. If I were to apply a constant force to move an object some distance, say x, then I could take the force times the distance is the work divided by the time. All right? If I move an object a certain distance over a particular time, what is that? Velocity. So if I want to know the power, I could also ask, what is actually the average force that I am applying? Okay, times the velocity at which this is being maintained, right? Whatever the velocity is, actually an average velocity. So this is a very loose derivation. So the power could also be represented in terms of the force and the velocity during the time that the object may move. More often than not, we'll be using this straightforward definition that the power is the work per time. There's nothing exciting about this. The hard part of doing any of these power problems would be in computing the work. Right? Work is force times distance. You know how to compute the work. You can figure out how much power there is. So an example. A quick example would be the following. Let's say I have 5 kilograms. Let's say this is raised 10 meters. At a constant velocity. Basically, right? Gravity's pulling down on it. I'm lifting it up. So basically, the only force I need to lift it is equivalent to the weight of that object. So let's say that I take an object and I raise it 10 meters, right? Which is 30 feet. So I have to, you know, walk up the steps or something, right? And let's say I do that in 1 minute. How much power is required to do it in 1 minute? So the power would be the work for time. The work is the force that I apply times the distance. The force to lift 5 kilograms is 5 times 9.8. That's the force. The distance I've moved it is 10 meters. and I need to divide that by the amount of time. I need to put it in seconds, so 60 seconds. Okay, so force times the distance divided by the time. So the hard part of doing power is usually the work. What'd you get?
8.2.
8.2 watts. Okay. Instead of walking up in 1 minute, I could run. All right? Okay, do it 15 seconds. How much power? I need 4 times as much. Okay, other units of power. That one can see. There's a whole section, nice tables on this. Okay, there's the horsepower. Okay. The horsepower. We used to measure things in horses. Of course, different horses gave different amounts, right? But now there's a standard. All right, so 1 horsepower is on the order of 750 watts. All right, let me make a couple of comments now and some remaining time about the problems. Once in a while in these problems, you're going to find a couple of different things to think about. Okay? For example, all right, you have somebody going down and sliding down a hill, and the next thing you know, they're falling through the air. All right? In this book, there are several problems which actually begin to mix stuff from chapters 2 and 3 with the energy problems. So you have all sorts of things like this. For example, here's one where you put a kid on a sliding board. All right, we'll just put a kid. Okay. This kid is moving at some initial velocity. Slides down, assuming it's frictionless, gets to the bottom, and of course, what does a kid want to do? It wants to get into the water, right? So now, if this is aimed flat, the kid can come flying out and hit the water. What is happening over here? Projectile motion. Which means we have to go back and think about projectile motion. Things that are typically given are, you know, the height, right? We know the height here. We know the distance, x. So x is v0xt, which, here's some v0x. For this part of the problem, that v0 is not the same as that. So sometimes you'll be asked things like, how high was the kid to start? Or how fast was the kid going here? If we know the height. So what do you have to do is break this into two problems and do the algebra that way until you get to the part where you can put in the numbers that you know. So up here, what do I have? If the kid starts off, say, coasting down the slide, you look at the total stored potential energy here. When you get to this part, the kid has a certain amount of energy. And then when the kid gets over here, right before he hits the water, right? So you can break that up. It may be the case that all you really need to know is that if there is no energy loss from this point to that point, that the total energy up here is going to be equal to the total energy right before they hit the water. And so you may not even need the projectile motion part. So you need to think about what's given. There's another typical type of problem which they display, which in some cases could be like a kid sitting in a swing, okay, or something to that effect. You typically have some length, a string, a rod, or whatever, a massless rod or whatever, could be the swing. You have a mass sitting here. That mass is pulled back. You let go of it, and you want to know when it swings down, how fast is it going? This is called a pendulum. We're going to look more at pendulum in a couple of chapters when we talk about springs. So the question here is, all right, what is the velocity at the bottom? If I know how far back I've pulled it, and I know how long that string is, okay, what you can do is look at this triangle. The change in height is that. You can put h equal to 0 here and ask, all right, this is height h. If I knew how high this mass were, then mgh here is equal to 1/2 mv squared there. You just need to do a little algebra to figure that out. Typically, you're given the length of that string, which is that entire length. You're given an angle, and so this side is going to be L times the cosine of the angle, so I can subtract that from the full length, and I know what this height is. But this chapter, the physics is very simple. If I know how high this mass is, and how high it is at the final part, right, then I can look at the change in potential energy and the change in kinetic energy here and just use conservation of energy. Again, you don't have to memorize some long, ugly formula for our energy. All right? If you know this, basically, and how to apply it, that's all you really need to know. At least it has to work energy theorem, right? All right, that's enough.